Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Edgar Lujano filling in for Cy Kelda today. It's great to be with you on this Friday. It's weird questions, if you didn't already tell by the weird music, fun weird music. Jimmy is in the middle of answering King Tardigrade's question. He had a question about bilocation and if bilocation is cloning, time travel, or doppelgangering. And Jimmy, you were in the middle of answering a few of those questions.
Yeah, so the specific option I was exploring at the moment was, could it be something like an angel appearing in your place? And I was mentioning that this interpretation actually has some traction in biblical studies, and I was recounting an incident from Acts chapter 12 where Herod Agrippa I was going to kill Peter, but an angel busts him out of jail. And when you've been busting out of jail, the first thing you need to do is get out of Dodge as quick as possible, because the sheriff's going to come after you. And so what Peter does is he goes to the house of John Mark's mother, and what he's really going to do is just stop in and tell the local Christian community, I'm going elsewhere. I've got out of jail, and now I'm going to go elsewhere. But when he starts knocking on the door, this servant girl named Rhoda comes to the door, and she's so excited to see Peter that she runs back into the back room where they're having a prayer meeting for him, because they all know he's been arrested and is going to be executed. So they're all in the back room praying for him. She runs back into the back room and is saying, it's Peter, it's Peter, he's at the door, he's at the door. And they don't believe her. And she just keeps insisting. And so they think of an explanation and they say, oh, it's his angel. And then Peter comes in and says, actually, guys, no, it's me in the flesh, and I've been busted out of jail, and I'm getting out of town now. The interesting thing for our purposes is, why do they say it's his angel? Well, if you read scholarly biblical commentaries on the book of Acts, a common proposal is that it's because this is the proposal that people, or at least some people in ancient Israel, thought that your guardian angel looks like you, or at least could look like you. They could like take your form or something. So since they believe Peter is off in jail and is unlikely to get out, they interpret the appearance of Peter at the door as being, oh, it's his guardian angel appearing in his form. And so that would essentially be what King Tardigrade is proposing as a possibility of, could like an angel take the form of a person and appear in their place? Could that be what's going on in cases of bilocation? Well, what I can say is I don't see a reason an angel couldn't do it. And here in Acts 12, we have at least some evidence that an angel might do it. Now, I don't know that I consider the explanation I just mentioned to be definitive, but it has been proposed and it does strike me as a plausible explanation. However, there are other phenomena that generate the appearance of bilocation, and the angelic explanation doesn't cover all of them. For example, the 20th century saint who is now officially called Saint Pio of Pietrelcina, but who to me will forever be known as Saint Padre Pio, he was well known for his bilocations, and the angelic explanation doesn't cover his experience. He would reportedly, he was a cloistered monk, so he'd be in his monastery. I've actually been to his monastery. I've been at Mass where he celebrated Mass. I've been back in, his room and seen his room and everything. But he would reportedly be in his monastery and he would kind of become quiet. I don't know if he'd close his eyes or not, but he would become quiet. And then he would have experiences of a distant location. And this is a paranormal ability known as clairvoyance. It's sometimes called remote viewing, but it's basically clairvoyance, and it could be done, you know, by God directly. It could be done by God using abilities that God had planted in human nature, so Padre Pio would have them. There's no real way to pull those apart and figure out the exact causation here, but Padre Pio would, kind of go into a trance, or at least get quiet and not interact with his immediate environment in the monastery. And he would then have experiences perceiving a distant place. And other people at that location would experience him being there. So, for example, in one case, he was bilocating, and he had the experience of being at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. And while he was having this experience, a young woman wanted to go to confession, who was at St. Peter's Basilica, wanted to go to confession. She grabs this priest and says, "Can you hear my confession?" And he says, "Sure." And he hears this woman's confession. And then months later, she visits the monastery, and she's like, "You were the guy who heard my confession." He's like, "Yep, I'm the guy who heard your confession down at St. Peter's." So this is what's known in parapsychology as an apparition of the living. So something is an apparition if it appears somewhere. Padre Pio appeared in St. Peter's Basilica, so it's an apparition, but he ain't dead. He's alive at this point. So it's an apparition of the living. And this is a well-known phenomenon. So what's the explanation here? Well, we don't have any evidence of angelic involvement. You know, he doesn't mention, "Oh, and my guardian angel took my place," or anything like that. This is just, he's having this experience. And so the way that apparitions of the living are conventionally understood, at least in parapsychological terms, is they're basically two forms of ESP involved: telepathy and clairvoyance. The telepathy allows the person at the location to perceive you, you know, because they're in telepathic contact with you. So that's how the woman in St. Peter's Basilica perceived Padre Pio being with her. That was a telepathic impression on her because he's not physically here. Clairvoyance is also involved because that's how Padre Pio is able to perceive her and what's going on in St. Peter's Basilica. So it looks like a combination of telepathy and clairvoyance, and that would seem to be something that God allows to happen in many cases of bilocation, particularly with saints. But there are other possibilities as well. So check out episode 212 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World for more.
Well, there you have it, King Tardigrade. Hopefully that's helpful. I certainly hope it was helpful to you, because it was for me. And with that, we go to our first break of the hour, and we come back with more weird questions right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
St. Carlo Acutis shared a dream in which Sister Lucia appeared to him, saying the first Saturday devotion could change the destiny of the world. The Blue Army of Our Lady of Fatima invites you to practice this devotion. Join a first Saturday virtual pilgrimage beginning December 6th. Experience spiritual meditations while traveling virtually through Portugal and Spain to 12 sacred sites tied to the Fatima story. Track your journey with a passport and stamps. Visit BlueArmy.com and select First Saturday Pilgrimage to learn more. Sponsored by Our Lady's Blue Army.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with a gospel message. You can enjoy EWTN live TV and radio streams, EWTN news, program schedules, prayers, and devotionals with the EWTN app. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. There's two things that every Catholic needs in his or her bookshelf, a Bible and a catechism. And the good news is, today through Sunday, you can go to shop.catholic.com. All Bibles and catechisms are 25% off when you use the promo code MUSTHAVE. That's one word, MUSTHAVE, at checkout. So order them today to arrive in time for Christmas. That's shop.catholic.com to get yourself a Bible or a catechism at 25% off when you use the promo code MUSTHAVE. This is a lot of fun, Jimmy, and we're going to keep on going. Let's go to Lord Wife. It says, my eight-year-old son, I'm already butchering this.
Yeah, it could be a daughter.
That's true.
Lord Wife doesn't say.
That's right. My eight-year-old wants to know why we don't have memories from when we are babies.
Okay, so I'm going to try to explain this without using big words as much as I can, but if I slip, I'll trust Lord Wife to translate into terms that your eight-year-old may be more familiar with. Humans have different types of memory. When we remember stories about what has happened to us, like let's say yesterday you went to the grocery store and you bought milk. Well, okay, you remember that happening. That's a story about what happened to you yesterday. You went to the grocery store and you bought milk. That is a type of memory, and this is a fancy term, but that is called an episodic memory. It's an episode from your life. Although, to help out, you'll notice I just said stories about things that have happened to us. There are other types of memories too. Not all of our memory is episodic. Not all of our memories are about stories. We, for example, know how to speak English. I know what the word store means, and I know what the word milk means. But merely because I know what those two words mean, I don't have a story. I don't remember even when I learned them. So this is a different type of memory than the episodic memory or story-based memory that we normally think of. So, Lord Wife, my suspicion is when your eight-year-old asks, why don't we have memories from when we're babies, that the eight-year-old means episodic memory, or why don't we remember the stories of what happened to us when we were babies? So that's how I'm going to proceed in answering it. Well, there's a debate. One reason may be that before a certain age, we don't have the ability to form memories of events like that, of stories of what happened to us, because our ability to form memories does change as we grow and develop and get older. In particular, there's a part of the brain, it's called the hippocampus, that is involved in memory formation. And the hippocampus, like other parts of our brain, grows and develops over time. It's, you know, like when we were all zygotes or single-celled organisms in our mother's womb, when we were just one cell, we didn't even have a brain. And so obviously all of the different parts of our brain that we use today had to grow and develop after that. And so they go through different stages of growth. And it's very possible that before a certain age, we don't yet have the parts of our brain developed enough to be able to form memories. And for a long time, people would say, oh, well, that's why babies can't remember. That's why we can't remember what happened to us when we were babies. We just didn't have the parts of our brain developed enough to be able to store memories. But there's reason to question that. One reason to question it is there have been some recent studies that suggests that children under 1 year old may be able to form memories. And you might wonder, well, how could you know? I mean, you can't ask a baby what happened yesterday. And even if you could and the baby could reply, it's going to be pretty much the same from one day to another. Well, I woke up, I cried, I had a bottle of breast milk, and then I fell asleep, and then I woke up again and cried. You know, it's going to be the same stuff. But because babies can't talk, for a long time, people didn't know how to do scientific studies to find out if babies can form memories. But that has been partially solved. Because one of the things that scientists have discovered is if babies are familiar with something, they stare at it longer. And so even though you can't ask a baby, do you remember this? You can show the baby something. And if the baby remembers it and it's brand new, they've never seen it before, they won't stare at it as long as if they have seen it before and remember it. And so in the last few years, they've been doing these staring studies with children from like 4 months old up to, you know, say 2 years old. And they found that children before 12 months are able to remember, oh yeah, I've seen that picture before, at least as evidenced by the fact they will stare at pictures they have been exposed to longer than they will stare at pictures they have not been exposed to. So that gives us evidence that they remember them. Now, it doesn't mean that they remember them the way we do, but we do have some evidence for memory formation in children under a year old. And that memory probably, the ability to remember probably develops it and really gets good by the time they're 3 or 4 years old. But we do have some evidence for memory formation in very small children. But they still don't remember a lot. And so even if we set aside, even if there is an age where they just can't form memories, there's another factor, and I'm going to have to use a technical term here, but it's called infantile amnesia. Amnesia is where you can't remember something, and infantile means when you're an infant. And so we experience infantile amnesia that seems to block out early memories that we formed when we were very small. And the probable reason for this form of amnesia is because our brain is growing and we're building new, I'm really trying to avoid technical terms, but basically our brains are made up of these little nerves called neurons. And as our brains grow, we create new neurons, and they can disrupt the old neurons that we used to have. And that appears to be part of what's responsible for infantile amnesia. There's also another form of amnesia that's a natural part of human growth. This is what's known as childhood amnesia. So childhood amnesia is from when you can't remember things, not from when you were a baby, but from later in your childhood. So most people, like I have a very dim memory from when I was 4 years old, but it's very dim. And a lot of people, you know, they can't remember things from when they were 4 years old or 5 years old or 6 years old or things like that once they're adults. And that's because of childhood amnesia. Well, childhood amnesia seems to be the same kind of thing. As our brains grow, the new structures in our brains disrupt the older structures that were there before. And childhood amnesia tends to set in around age 7. So your 8-year-old is probably already starting to not remember some things from when your 8-year-old was 3 or 4 or 5 or 6. And as an adult, probably won't be able to remember all that stuff. But good news, if there's something that your 8-year-old would like to remember as an adult, think about it now and think about it often to reinforce that memory so that it will survive the childhood amnesia that your 8-year-old is experiencing. And if the child completely forgets it, well, you won't miss it. So, you know, most adults are not burdened by the fact that we don't have a lot of memories from when we were 4 or 5 or something like that. We go through life just fine. It'll be fine. And it's good that we actually have childhood memory because it enables our brains to grow and mature and do the more powerful brain work that we'll need to do as adults. So it appears that with infantile amnesia and childhood amnesia, they actually are important stages in growth and development. And yeah, it would be cool to be able to remember more things, but actually it's a good thing that we don't remember everything. In fact, there is a condition, and I have to use a fancy word for it, but it's called highly superior autobiographical memory. And people who have highly superior autobiographical memory, there's not very many of them. The actress Mary Lou Henner is one of them. People who have highly superior autobiographical memory, they really can remember tons of stuff. Not everything, but tons of stuff. You could say, where were you on March 7th, 1980? Mary Lou Henner would be able to say, oh, I was on the set of Taxi that day, the TV show I was on. Okay, she can do that, but there are problems if you remember absolutely everything, because you not only remember the good stuff that's happened to you, you remember the bad stuff. And there are things that it's better to just not have to be burdened by remembering that. I mean, and actually, you know, when you were a kid and felt helpless as a baby and were crying and in anguish and everything, that's probably one of those things you wouldn't want to keep remembering all the time. So there are benefits to not remembering everything. And the reason why we don't remember from events from when we were babies is probably a combination of things, including not being able to form memories for a while, and then having infantile amnesia, and then having childhood amnesia. But these are all important stages of growth that help set us up to be healthy, successful adults that have really strong brain power.
All right. That was, I got to give you kudos. That was great for a great answer for an 8-year-old child. That's fantastic. Well, there's a couple of words you threw in there, but that's actually pretty impressive, especially for a very long answer like that.
Yeah, well, I try to do what I can, but I'm confident that Lord Wife will be able to translate in case I used any words that the 8-year-old may not know.
There you go.
But I want to compliment the 8-year-old for thinking about this question, because it's a very interesting question, and a lot of people don't think about it.
Yeah, I always thought that there were no more studies about it. It's just something you don't think about. Why would you look into the memory of a child when it looks like they really don't have any? But it makes sense, because they're going to constantly they remember people, they remember things, they remember their favorite toys. So by the time they actually start having memory or start being more conscious, they're already aware of all these things. Yeah. Well, before we go to the hard break here, I wanted to ask you, because it's been already an hour and a half and I haven't asked you. Today's Friday, so Mysterious World came out. So what's today's episode?
Yeah, so today is a patrons questions episode. While I was over in Italy, we did a couple of Q&A sessions for the patrons who went with us. And so you'll see a video of me and my co-host Don Bettinelli over in Italy in one of those sessions answering their questions. Among other things, we answer questions about the Eye of Providence and where it comes from. That's the symbol you see on the back of the dollar bill with the all-seeing eye on top of a pyramid, and what is that all about? Well, that's one of the topics we cover.
Okay, well, there you have it. For people who want to go check that out after these next 30 minutes, so you get an extra dose of Jimmy today. And since we have another minute, you have another podcast, the Jimmy Akin podcast, where you tackle more faith-based questions, and it comes out on Mondays. So what was this past Monday's episode?
This last Monday was an episode responding to a popular internet influencer named Father Casey Cole, who did a couple of videos telling people that it is not appropriate when you have returned from communion to pray and say thank you to God. He insisted in his videos that you need to be singing along with everybody else. And that's not true. And if you read what the law actually says carefully, now, a lot of people took offense when he said that because they had been taught, oh, you know, it's a good thing to say thank you after you've received your Lord in Holy Communion. And other people were afraid because they got scrupulous about, you know, am I allowed to do this? But I want to say thanks, but am I allowed to? And they would feel torn because of what he said. So we did a careful reading of the law, and we showed actually he was mistaken. You are permitted to say thank you to your Lord who you've just received in Holy Communion, and you do not have to have everybody in the church singing. In fact, some churches distribute communion without any singing.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
On Monday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, our topic will be, was there a time when you knew Mary was praying for you? And now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Once again, Edgar Lujano, producer for the show, filling in for Cy Kellett today. He's making his way around Oklahoma there with Carlo and Joe. So if you're in the Oklahoma area, I think they're doing another event tomorrow. I could be wrong on that. But yeah, anyways, go check them out if you're in that area. Today's weird questions with Jimmy. So we're not taking any calls. We have all the questions we need. So sit back, relax, take a sip of your hot chocolate or your coffee if you are a late night coffee drinker. Hello, and Joe. So if you're in the Oklahoma area,
or they could be
tomorrow. I could be wrong on that. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit of feedback
anyways,
there. Go check them out if you're in that area.
Are you hearing me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit of feedback. Hey, Ben, do you mind fixing that for me? Thank you very much. Sorry about that. That was a little strange. Jimmy, shall we go back to the calls then? Or the calls?
Sure.
The questions.
Yeah.
All right. This is let's go to Jim Longhurst 707. He says, "Greetings from Northern England, where we also eat dinner in the middle of the day. My question is this: if an infinite multiverse does indeed exist, does that mean that in each universe, God would either have to, one, not create rational beings capable of falling, or two, when he does, incarnate in each universe to redeem it? If a third option is possible, it would seem that the fall and the incarnation are not necessary. And if they aren't, God wouldn't be perfectly good in allowing them."
Okay, so I guess I should probably explain what Jim is referring to about eating dinner in the middle of the day. This is based on a shift in terms of English vocabulary. The way, at least in America, the way most, and I think in much of England as well, or much of the United Kingdom as well, the term dinner has become associated with the evening meal. Now, when you think about, if you say to someone, "Would you like to come over for dinner?" They're thinking coming over in the evening, and in the United Kingdom, after tea time. Tea time is its own thing. It's like, you know, I don't know, 4 p.m. or something. That they're thinking later in the day than that. But this is not the historic usage. The historic usage of the term dinner is for the main meal of the day, which in many places was the noontime meal. And so when I grew up, and I had relatives in Texas and Arkansas and so forth, we would commonly refer to lunch as dinner. Hmm. And then the evening meal was known as supper. So you'd wake up, you'd have breakfast, then you'd have dinner at noon, then you'd have supper in the evening. So that's what Jim is referring to when he says that in Northern England, they also eat dinner in the middle of the day.
So is lunch not a thing?
No, we called lunch dinner.
Fair. That's fair.
Yeah. We still had three meals a day, but the names were different.
Gotcha.
So supper is the last one that today is most commonly called dinner. Lunch was commonly called dinner. And then breakfast was always breakfast because you broke your daily fast at breakfast. In any event, to get to Jim's question about there being an infinite multiverse, first thing I should point out, we don't have evidence for a multiverse unless you want to count heaven as another universe, maybe hell, but prescinding from those spiritual locations. We don't have evidence for physical realms that are not contiguous. I'm not talking to an 8-year-old anymore. Okay. I can use words like contiguous, that are not contiguous with our physical universe. It's also going to depend on how you define multiverse, but we don't have evidence for other universes that are physical in nature, much less do we have evidence for an infinite number of them. So this is a metaphysical proposal rather than something we have scientific evidence for. Jim doesn't seem to be confused about that point. I just want to point it out for the audience that this is built into the question. We're making an assumption that there are such universes. So if there are such universes, Jim asks, would God have to not create rational beings capable of falling in them, or would he have to incarnate in each universe to redeem it after a fall? And so the first question, would God not have to create rational beings capable of falling? I would say the answer is no, because God is omnipotent. He is capable of doing anything that does not involve a logical contradiction. It's obvious that creating rational beings capable of falling does not involve a logical contradiction because we hear our race fell, we exist, and God created us. So there's obviously not a logical contradiction in the idea of a universe containing created beings that have a rational nature that are capable of falling, because if that did, we wouldn't be able to exist, and we do. therefore, QED, there's no logical contradiction here, and God could do the same thing in other universes that he did here if there are other universes. So that takes care of the first question. He could create rational beings capable of falling in other universes. That then lets us proceed to the second question. When God does create such beings, does he have to incarnate in each universe to redeem it? Well, there's a second assumption there, not just that these universes exist, but also that the beings fell. Maybe they didn't. Maybe God created rational beings capable of falling in another universe who chose to exercise their free will in such a way that that they didn't fall. In the case of that universe or such universes, he wouldn't need to incarnate to redeem them. Now, he might, per Blessed John Duns Scotus's view, he might choose to incarnate anyway, even if they didn't fall, but he wouldn't have to in order to redeem them. So that then, but let's put that aside and say, okay, let's assume they've fallen. Would God have to incarnate in each universe to redeem it? Well, I can imagine some folks saying that he wouldn't have to incarnate on the ground, that he wouldn't have to redeem them at all. Mercy is mercy. It's not something that is obligatory. So you could look at a verse like 2 Peter 2:4 and say maybe God doesn't choose to redeem races that fall all the time. What 2 Peter 2:4 says is, "For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into Tartarus and committed them to pits of deepest darkness to be kept until the judgment." And then this is a hugely long sentence that finally finishes up in verse 9, five verses later. "Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trial and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment." So extracting the relevant parts of this super kaiju sentence, if God did not spare the angels when they sinned but cast them into Tartarus, then he knows how to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. The part for us that's most significant is didn't spare the angels when they sinned. So you could say, well, if some intelligent race in another universe falls, maybe God would choose not to extend mercy to them, but only justice. And that you would then argue, if you make that assumption, that this is consistent with God's character, because he's not only merciful, he's also just. In some cases, he may apply mercy. In other cases, he may apply strict justice. That's one way you could argue it. But I would note that that recent magisterial teaching seems to move in a different direction. If you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it says that the reason that angels are not redeemed after they fall is not because of a limitation of the divine mercy. Instead, it's because of the irrevocable character of their choice. The way their minds work, once they make a choice for good or evil, it sticks. At least if they make a choice for evil, it sticks. They don't repent. And so so that's why they don't get mercy. It's not that God, according to the Catechism, it's not that God isn't willing to give them mercy. It's that their minds do not want it. They make this irrevocable choice for evil, and God says, okay, you chose evil. I'm giving you what you wanted. You're going to have punishment. If that is the explanation for why God didn't spare the angels when they sinned, it's not that he has a limit on his mercy that would let him just say, oh, well, I'm not going to redeem people who want to be redeemed. I'm not going to choose to do that. So if there are beings in other universes that have fallen, and if they're like humans and are capable of repentance, then God would need to redeem them out of his infinite mercy. How would that happen? to get to Jim's question, would it require him to incarnate in each of these other universes? And the answer, according to St. Thomas Aquinas, and here's a place where I agree with Aquinas, the answer is no. That God could, because God can do anything, that it doesn't involve a logical contradiction, well, the idea of redeeming us without incarnating doesn't seem to involve a logical contradiction. So you can imagine God just saying, okay, you're repentant, I forgive you, and not have any incarnation, not have any go under the cross or the electric chair or some other painful form of execution. He could just say, I forgive you. And that doesn't involve a logical contradiction, so it seemed God could do that. So he would not need to incarnate in another species in order to redeem that species. He could do it in an infinite number of ways, only some of which involve incarnations. Now, you might then say, well, why did he choose to incarnate in our case? Why did he choose to send his son to go to the cross for us? Well, I would say, and again, this is in concert with Aquinas, to teach us lessons, because seeing Jesus goes to the cross teaches us at least two important lessons. One is how grave our sins are, that it took the death of the Son of God to compensate for them. And second, that God loves us in spite of that. So that's how much he loves us. He was willing to do this for us. So I would say, in my opinion, that that's why he chose this path with us, to teach us those lessons. But not every species is us. Different species would think different ways if they exist. And God himself has choices about how he's going to interact with each species he chooses to create. And so even though he chose incarnation followed by the cross for us, he wouldn't have to make that choice for every other fallen race capable of redemption that he creates.
Jim, thank you so much for your question. Let's go to the final break, and when we come back, it's more weird questions right here on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Apparently, our Christianity demands humility, it demands compassion, demands that you love and pray for your enemy. We don't like that too much either.
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. This episode has been just so much fun. Every time we do weird questions, every time you guys have done weird questions before I worked here, I always enjoyed them. Now I get to be on this end, so it's an absolute pleasure. So let's go back. Let's continue on down the list. We go over to Ben York, 3895, asks, if we could quickly travel vast distances in space and also had extreme telescope technology, would it be possible to travel thousands of light years away, then turn around our amazing telescopes back on Earth and watch the pyramids being built, or travel 65 million light years and see what killed the dinosaurs?
Mm-hmm. In principle, the answer is yes. Now, there are some complications to that. One of them is that light radiates according to what's sometimes called the cube square law. So every time light doubles the amount of distance from the source it's emitted from, the amount of light is a third of a cube of that distance. So if, let's say at one mile, the light emitting from the surface of the Earth has a value of one. But then when you go to 2 miles, it's going to be an eighth. And when you go to 3 miles, it's going to be, what would that be, 1/27th or something like that. That's why stars that shine very brightly don't burn our eyes out and when we see them in the night sky, because even though the star may be huge, it's so far away that we're only getting a little sliver of light from it. Well, and we can't see planets with the naked eye around other stars at all. We can't even see all the planets around our own star. We can see, if you got good eyes, you can see as far out as Saturn. And on rare occasions, you could even see Uranus, but it's so out there that nobody in antiquity even noticed it. They thought Saturn was the farthest out planet, and they thought the fixed stars were like on this big shell just outside the orbit of Saturn, and they thought that's the entire universe. It's just this series of shells that ends with a final shell right beyond the orbit of Saturn. So we can't see planets with the naked eye around other stars at all. And even with our modern telescopes, it's hard to do so. So if you want to see something like the pyramids being built, well, okay, that happened about 5,000 years ago. So they're old kingdom. So you'd want to go 5,000 light years away. And as Ben York says, if we want to see the dinosaurs, you're going to need to go about 65 million years away. But if you want to see these events, you're going to have to collect the light that was coming from Earth at that time. And when you get 5,000 light years away or 65 million light years away, you're not getting much light from Earth. You're lucky to get one photon. So how can you get the light you need to see what you want to see? Well, one way is you build a freaking huge telescope that is itself light years across. But that's kind of expensive, you know, and you need to tear apart solar systems in order to get the matter needed to build a telescope that huge to gather all that light. Are there any cheaper ways to do it? There is one, and it is known as aperture synthesis. It turns out that if you want to view something that you can't build a big enough telescope to see, you can build different smaller telescopes and put them at distant locations and then use them as light sensors and integrate the light you're getting from these different smaller telescopes. So let's say we wanted to view something, that's too far away to see with any normal telescope here on Earth. What we could do is put one telescope, a normal size telescope, on one side of the Earth and another telescope of the same size on the opposite side of the Earth. And then we could look at the distant object with both telescopes and integrate the light coming in from those two different telescopes. That's what's known as aperture synthesis. So we don't have to build a single telescope that is light years across, but we would need to pepper widely distant points in space that are light years apart with small telescopes that we could then collect the data from and integrate it through aperture synthesis in order to create. So we need a telescope swarm spanning light years rather than one single telescope spanning light years. And we could, in principle, get images of the pyramids being built or the dinosaurs being exterminated or anything like that. If we could get far enough out in space and could build a telescope swarm big enough to do it, we could get those images in principle.
Well, there you have it, Ben York. Maybe we'll eventually get there, but I don't think we'll see that anytime soon, at least in our lifetime.
I would expect the quicker way to do it is just wait until you die and then go look it up in the archives in heaven.
There you go. That's a conversation that I've had with Jeff. The most interesting thing that we're looking forward to is just, you know, asking questions like, how did everything happen? Mm-hmm. And we get to actually see those things. So that's a great question, Ben.
Well, it is reported in near-death experiences that people, there are reports of huge increases in the amount of knowledge people have in a near-death experience. They just can't bring it all back with them. But they will say, people who've had near-death experiences will report, all I had to do was think about a subject, and suddenly I knew everything about it.
Wow. That's cool. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go to another question. Wrong but loud. I got to say, Jimmy, that name applies to a lot of people on the internet. So,
all wrong, right. But loud. That's, yeah, right. I would agree. At right. least he's owning it.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Good on you. Wrong, but loud. He asks, or she, we don't know, could some cryptids be demons in disguise?
Okay. So anytime anybody says a question could, and they ask about an unknown, like cryptids, which are hidden animals, like, you know, Bigfoot or whatever, Mongolian death worms would be another cryptid. I haven't yet done an episode on Mongolian death worms, but I plan to. They're undiscovered, so they're unknowns. And anytime demons are also largely unknowns. We know some about demons, you know, like what we read in scripture, but not a ton. Well, anytime anybody asks a question of the form, could this be the case? The answer almost always is, well, hypothetically, yeah. The question is, so if someone says, could some cryptids be demons in disguise? Well, we know angels can impersonate humans. They can take on physical bodies temporarily and pass as humans. In fact, the book of Hebrews mentions that some have entertained angels unaware that that's what they were doing, that they had an angel over for dinner. So if angels can imitate humans convincingly, even doing physical things, then demons can too, because they're just bad angels. So in principle, yeah, demons could imitate or create physical bodies that correspond to Bigfoot or Mongolian death worms or whatever you want, and pass as them. But the question, as always, is, well, what evidence do you got for it? You know, like if someone said, could a demon impersonate, you know, Edgar Lujano? I would say, well, yeah, in principle, but what evidence do you have that Edgar Lujano is really a demon in disguise? I'm not aware of any. I'm sure he needs to go to confession occasionally, but I don't think of him as a demon. I don't have evidence for that.
That's fair.
So I would say we should not leap to a conclusion that some cryptids are demons without evidence any more than we should leap to the conclusion that Edgar Lujano is really a demon in disguise without evidence for that being the case. Also, part of the evidence that I think needs to be looked at is, what's the historical pattern of demonic behavior? Do they normally go around impersonating unknown animals? Do they normally go around impersonating living human beings like Edgar Lujano? No. They try to tempt people to sin. They try to get worshipped as gods. They try to possess people and make their lives miserable. But none of those things involve impersonating unknown animals or impersonating Edgar Lujano. So I would say the presumption based on the known patterns of demonic behavior is that they're not doing this. Could they? Yeah. But until we have evidence that that's what they're doing, I don't think it's worth entertaining that hypothesis.
I think that's a good way of approaching it, is looking at the pattern of behavior of anything before you even ask the question. So
yeah.
Look at the pattern of behavior and see where it takes you.
Of course, that is exactly what a demon would say in this situation.
One will never know, right? Well, Jimmy, this has been a great hour. Before we finish this off, I just want to quickly read the pitch one more time that Carrie gave me. Two things that every Catholic needs in his or her bookshelf. Of course, a Bible and a catechism. So go to shop.catholic.com. Use the promo code MUSTHAVE, as one word, MUSTHAVE, and you get 25% off at checkout. So again, shop.catholic.com, MUSTHAVE, and you get 25% off all Bible and catechisms. This was just too much fun, Jimmy. I really, really appreciated you having here and just having a great time with me.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, that's going to do it for us here at Catholic Answers. Jimmy, thank you so much for today. And we're not going to be here on Monday since it is the feast of the Solemnity of the Immaculate Conception. So we will see you here on Tuesday. There will be a pre-recorded episode that we did with Carlo on Sola Scriptura. So check that out. But we will see you here live on Tuesday of next week. God bless you all. This has been Catholic Answers Live.